When the staff heard we'd be talking about puffins today, there was great excitement. Oh, they're so cute, and be sure and tell people how short they are. And then from Peter, wait, are we talking about the cereal? No, we're talking about the seabird with the black and white coat of a penguin and the face of a clown. A huge Groucho Marx orange beak and bright orange feet. What was the creator thinking? 45 years ago, when then grad student Stephen Kress heard that a nesting population of puffins on Maine's Egg Rock Island had been completely wiped out, he decided to do something no ornithologist had ever done, restore the native bird population. Steve is now vice president for bird conservation with the National Audubon Society. His new book is Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring Puffins Back to Egg Rock. And he joins us from Cornell University, where he teaches field ornithology. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And your co-author on the book is photojournalist and Boston Globe editorial board member and longtime columnist Derek Jackson, who's in the studio with us. Derek, welcome to you.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, Derek, when I mentioned the puffin cereal, you tell us that's actually not far off?
The puffin cereal? That has an official relationship with the Audubon Project.
Right. They raise money.
That's right.
For puffins. So Peter wasn't that far off. But Steve, what about the puffins? At the story's outset in the early 70s, why were they missing from Egg Rock? Because there were healthy populations of puffins in the world.
Right. Robin, puffins and most other birds on the Maine coast, especially the water birds, have been heavily hunted for food. It was such an extensive process that it ended up sort of wiping them out off most of the Maine coast.
Well, you have a light bulb moment. You have several, actually, over the course of decades. But one is when you read that puffins used to breed on this Egg Rock, which has now been taken over by seagulls.
Well, that was a real eye-opener to me because I had been at those islands before, and I thought they were great the way they were. They were filled full of gulls and cormorants and a few guillemots. But once I realized that the puffins were right there in our backyard, that just seemed wrong to me, and I thought, well, wouldn't it be terrific if I could just bring them back? And I thought, this probably, I could do this in a few summers, being so young and ambitious. Here we are, going into our 42nd summer of managing these islands now. But we've learned a lot along the way.
Well, let's explain to people, yours was a two-pronged effort that's now imitated around the world, but you were the first to do it. Puffins return to breed where they were born. They fly off after they hatch and then come back to breed. So part one was you had to somehow get newborns on Egg Rock so that they could then return. That's called translocation. You had to get chicks from somewhere else. Part two would be getting the puffins that had returned to breed with each other. One of my favorite lines in any book of recent memory is when one of your researchers yells out, "Look, a copulation." But look at to that in a minute. Start with, how did you convince people in Canada, where there were healthy populations of chicks, that you weren't some crazy guy when you went up and said, "I want to bring some of your chicks down to this rock off of Maine"?
This was all happening at a time when most people believed that let nature run its course.
Right.
Conservation was too often about documenting declining populations. The idea of trying to restore populations or bring birds back to places or expand ranges, all that was very novel. And really, many people thought, why bother? I was able to work with the Canadian Wildlife Service, who began slowly to realize that if we could accomplish this with puffins in the U.S., there would be benefit for Canadian puffins in the future as well.
Well, you make such an important point, because this was before there was the sense that man could intervene with nature, and you and others made the case that not only had man disrupted nature by the hunting these birds, but also by, I mean, there was a wholesale slaughter of birds when their feathers were used for hats. There was the chemical industry, DDTs. You and others were making the case, no, man can interfere with nature when man has already interfered with nature. And you began this process. I just want to jump to Derek for a second, because I know you didn't meet Steve till later. But as you're helping him tell his story, are you thinking, wow, this guy, what a quixotic idea?
Yeah. And in fact, I think one of the things that I'm impressed about is whether this could happen today. The project started in 1973, but there was no returning puffins for 4 years. And then even after puffins started returning, there was still no breeding for a total of 7 years. And so the first breeding pairs came back in 1981. And to think of in this current environment of funding cuts, where science is often seems like it's all about a biotech finding a magic pill, I really wonder if you propose this project today. Hey, I want to bring hundreds of little chick puffins back from Newfoundland. I'm going to put them in little holes, and I'm going to feed them, and I'm going to feed them fish, and they're going to go off to nowhere that I have no clue where they're going to go.
Right.
And they're going to go off for years and years, and we don't know. And by the way, you're going to fund me for 8 years until we get
them to come back.
Come back.
And then convince them to mate with each other.
Right.
Well, Steve, that's sort of the end of the story, but take us back to, you've got these little fragile chicks. You're now responsible for their lives. You and a handful of researchers are having to put them in these burrows. You have to hand feed them these pieces of fish. You're essentially their parents. How frightening was that initially?
Well, we didn't really know very much about being puffin parents, but yet there we were. And we also realized the consequences of failure, because if these chicks died or something ate them, there would be no more puffins, and the whole idea would collapse. Fortunately, what we discovered soon into this was the puffins are very hardy little birds, and most of them, over 90% of them, headed off to sea in good condition.
The fledging, it's such a mysterious thing. At a certain point, there's a siren call. They stop eating, and they just start heading towards the sea, and they go, and it's a breathtaking moment. What was that moment like for you guys?
The drama here really is the absence of any feedback from the birds for years. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many things you could worry about. You'd go to all this effort, and they would head off to sea, and they just sank, and losing their waterproofing. Other issues about putting bird bands on them. Would the bands stay on them? Would they actually attract fish because they were shiny little things on their legs? When you're doing something for the first time, there's lots of mistakes you could make. But the challenge here was that once the birds headed to sea, they were on their own. We didn't really know whether we had done it right or not.
Well, it turns out you'd done it quite right. Although you mentioned the waterproofing, and if you handle the chicks wrong, they lose that amazing waterproofing in their feathers. That's what keeps them afloat. That's ornithologist Stephen Kress of the Audubon Society and Cornell University. His new book, Project Puffin, is about his 42-year effort to restore a puffin colony in Maine. We're also speaking with photographer and co-author Derek Jackson. And let's pick up the story. The puffins do come back, some of them, but how to make them stay. This brings us to the social attraction part. You think maybe we lure more of them. So you have puffin decoys made. You build a box with a mirror so if a puffin does land, he thinks there's another puffin there. Talk about that.
4 years into the project, 1977, spring of 77, really was a watershed year. The Canadian Wildlife Service was questioning whether we should continue since we hadn't seen any come back. Donors were beginning to ask reasonable questions like, why should I support this? And the decoys, it turned out to be remarkably attractive to the puffins. This was a terrific high to see the first puffin after waiting so long, wondering whether, in fact, any would ever show up. The first one that landed was so close to my boat that I was able to see that it had a leg band on its foot.
And you write there was a moment when your wife came running across the island screaming, puffin with fish. You say these are the three most important words of your career. What did that mean to you?
Well, there we were, 8 years into this,
yeah,
in our eighth summer. A puffin flying with fish means that there's a chick, a little chick under the rocks, and that puffin is bringing fish to that chick. And if that puffin were to drop into the rocks and come out without the fish, that would be proof. And we eventually saw that, and
yeah,
that was the thing that we had almost hesitated to talk about after so many years of just sort of waiting.
Yeah. Derek, you got involved in the mid-'80s. What happened for you? Because obviously you fell hard for a puffin, too.
The thing that got me back in 1986 when I did it for Newsday is here's this visionary doing this seemingly crazy thing, and yet it was really restoring something that was lost. And the instincts that he used to figure out, well, okay, so we're not getting puffins back, so what do we do? Guessed on decoys, guessed right on decoys, and then figured out that terns. It turned out to be a protective cover for puffins.
They fight off the gulls.
That's right.
Well, Steve, there are now 1,000 pairs of puffins on 5 islands. And this thinking of yours has been applied to bird populations around the world, restored them. People take boats. If you ever go to Maine, you have to get on one of the sightseeing boats and go see the puffin populations, as people do all the time. When you look back over the decades, though, and you think, you know, living in the freezing rain on those tents on the island, scraping through bird guano, do you ever marvel at the amount of time you spent?
You know, this has been a journey for me personally and professionally, and just when you think you have fixed things, you realize you haven't. I'm hopeful from all of this, but the challenges are great, and we're discovering new things all the time.
Well, Derek, your pictures are incredible. Again, we'll post them at hereandnow.org.
Thank you, Robin.
And Stephen Kress, thank you to you as well.
Thank you very much, Robin.